Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for mid-July. We are so excited. We have wanted to do this for ever. We've wanted to get into field recordings, and we've been thwarted, you know, not having the proper equipment, and then we had the whole virus come in. And we finally today are out in the field in Nora Petrich's wetland, actually, the wetlands behind her area. And we have coaxed our friend and expert, Dr. Jeff Hammerson, to come out with us and look for amphibians. Jeff is a great naturalist, but amphibians are his specialty. So welcome, Jeff.
Oh, thank you, Debron. It's a pleasure. It's always so fun to get out into the field and wade into the pond and take your net and see what we're going to find. So it'll be really interesting because we haven't looked here before, so it's all going to be new.
We've got a little bit of birding in there, and of course, what would a wetland be without some of the characteristic vegetation? But first, we're going to get a bit of context from Nora, because you've been here for over 30 years.
Yes, that's right. And I'll give you a brief history of the hydrology of this area because it's been fascinating to watch.
We bought these 4+ acres in 1990, and it had been a cow pasture with a dug pond that was used for watering the cattle. As we got to know our neighbors, we learned a few things. One is that many of the acres had been scraped of its topsoil in this little lakes region just west of town here. We also learned that our patch of land flooded frequently. We naively thought that by digging a back pond, we could catch excess water and keep the fields from flooding. We had built the house at the end of a dry season, and by mid-90s and into 2005 and beyond, the winters turned cold and the ponds froze. We did ice skating back in those days. And I recall that there was a fair amount of snowfall during those years. And I noticed that it was a snowfall above all else that seems to bring the water table up. Now, I'm no scientist, but that's my theory. And so in between these high water events that we endured, the ponds also can dry up. The back pond has completely dried up 3 times.
So, Jeff, what would happen to the larvae, the eggs, if the pond dried up? What wouldn't be eggs if they'd be larvae at that stage? What would happen to them? Would they burrow into the mud, and would they be able to stay alive, or do they actively need water?
Well, for the species that occur around here, they pretty much need to have that liquid water. And so in these ponds that are very dynamic, that is that the water is there in abundance in some years and not in other years, or for periods of several years consecutively, you can have like boom or bust reproduction where you have 2 or 3 years of tremendous amounts of egg laying and larval thriving and new frogs and salamanders coming out of the pond to start a new generation. And they can live several years, so that then you might subsequently get a dry spell where the water dries up and it hasn't stayed there long enough to support the whole life cycle, and you get 100% mortality. Mm. They don't really have the ability to live very long if the water disappears. A little bit, you know, if it's a very brief, a few days, maybe they could be under a piece of wood or something, but by and large, drying of the pond means complete mortality for the larval stages or the eggs that are in there.
We're about to head out on Explorers, but before we do, let's hear the mystery sound of the week. And a big hint for this one is that it's something related, something that would live in our ponds. We'll tell you what it is at the end of the program, and, well, Jeff will mostly tell you what it is. All right, we're going to sally forth.
We're now wading through the waist-high grass to get to the back ponds. Oops, watching out for crops of Canadian thistle. Thistles and other weeds like tansy ragwort and poison hemlock try to make their home in this long-disturbed soil, which is why I'm curious to learn what Jeff and Debron can tell me about these ponds' ecology. We see barn swallows and violet green swallows swooping down, and the red-winged blackbirds are getting agitated. I surprisingly didn't see any ducklings in the ponds this year. We often get mallards, American widgeons, buffleheads, some teals.
Oh, look at that. Look at, it looks like it's got some pale yellow on its throat and another bit of yellow on its underneath its tail, a long tail that it's pumping up and down, and it looks like it's protecting its territory here. What do you think that is?
Yeah, I think it's a common yellowthroat female. And a little farther away, there's what is probably the male calling. So they may have a nest in here.
Oh, that's cool.
They're acting like they're concerned about
these intruders.
Our intrusion. But we're not going over that way, so they're okay.
This is the what you would expect their habitat to be. You'd expect to find them here.
The wetland thickets, basically. They like very thick vegetation. They sometimes go up in bushes, but
in trees.
Not so much trees aren't necessary.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's okay to have a few scattered around. But they like the open areas. There we have a lot of cattails and tall grasses.
Here she comes again. I'd like to see the male.
He's very close, but he's hidden in the grass there.
Oh, the females come over now.
The male common yellowthroat, which is a type of warbler.
Oh, I see now. God, he's beautiful. He has a really striking white eyebrow and a black mask.
Yeah.
Oh, he's gorgeous.
Take a sample and see if there are any amphibian larvae on the bottom here. Quite an assortment of, we've got salamander larvae. Do one more and then I'll come into the shallower water and join you. Water is actually pretty warm, so I'm quite happy. We have a little ecosystem in the container.
Jeff, with the sandals and the shorts, was able to wade in where Nora and I were limited to the height of our rubber boots, and he was able to scoop up some really cool stuff from the pond. So what have you got, Jeff?
Okay, so we were pretty successful with just three scoops. We have, there's a frog tadpole in here, which is a larval stage, and it's pretty large actually, almost 2 inches long, maybe inch and a half. And I'm looking at its eyes because that helps you tell what you're seeing. And they go right out to the far edges of the head. So that's a Pacific tree frog.
Wow. It's a big larva for as small as they are.
Yeah. They're chunky as a larva as they transform into the little frog stage. They actually shrink somewhat.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they lose all that tail.
Yeah.
So what we're looking at is like 2/3 tail or maybe even more than that.
Uh-huh. How old will that be?
Okay, so that one, remember the frog choruses back in late winter, early spring, like March and April, when you hear at all the little wetlands around the frogs calling very loudly and continuously on the certain nights, like a warm night or after a rain. So that was the breeding event that this originated from. And they spend a few months in the water. And this one's already...
As eggs.
The eggs are only... That stage is short.
Uh-huh.
Week or so. And then the larval stage, which we're looking at here, lasts maybe 2 or 3 months, depending on the water temperature and so forth. But this one, you can see it actually has its hind legs.
The teeny, teeny little hind legs. I brought my jeweler's loop, which I use mostly for botanical work, but I think it'll be good.
Here. Oh, look how cool that is.
You might be able to make out the expanded toe tips already. So we're looking at a magnifier at the toes. And yeah, those are definitely identifiable as tree frog toes because they have like a wide tip already. So I imagine there are probably hundreds, if not thousands, of those in there. And we just sampled a small part that's relatively deep. So what they would probably be doing is crowding into the shallow, wherever the shallowest parts are when the sun comes out, because warmer, they've developed faster.
We've had all these warm, sunny days, but today is a typical Pacific Northwest day where it's cool and a little bit misty, so they're deeper in the water, right?
Yeah, they're not really, there's no warm shallows today yet. And now we also have some salamander larvae.
I saw that with the little fans around.
Can you see?
I can't believe how small they are.
Mm-hmm. There's one, two, three, four of those. And they're a little bit different sizes. They're all newts, rough-skinned newts.
Oh, how cool. So how do you tell at this stage that it's a rough-skinned newt?
Well, a newt is a kind of salamander, and you can tell that it is a salamander by the fact that even at this small stage, they have external gills and they have four legs.
And by small, we should define for the radio audience what we mean.
These are about an inch. The big one is a little over an inch, maybe an inch and a half.
And some of them are teeny.
And then there's others that are, just half an inch. But there's a few things that you should notice. For example, they have all four legs developed and external gills.
The fans that look like they're wearing a little boa around
feather boa around the neck.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And notice how the frog tadpole, it's only showing its hind legs at this point, and it has no external gills visible. So that's frog, and then the four-legged ones with the external gills are salamanders. And then you have to ask, okay, well, what kind of salamander? Uh-huh. Yeah. And as I mentioned, newts are a type of salamander.
And as most people that live in this area know, the newts, when they're adults, the rough-skinned newts, are those gorgeous creatures that we often see crossing the road slowly with the brilliant orange bellies and the brown surface to them. They cross the road looking like they're giving a slow grin, and they are much beloved. We see them as adults on land, but then they come to the ponds to breed when? Mm-hmm. When do they?
Well, there was a big migration this year, probably mostly in March, but it'll start sometimes in February, but March seemed to be like the peak this year. So late winter, early spring, whenever they get those rains and the temperature gets up into the mid to upper 40s, then they start moving from the forest into the ponds. So around here, there's some forested patches nearby, which they may be using. It's very open here in this area, so one possibility is that they spend more time in the water here than in the forest. They can adapt their behavior based on kind of the local conditions. If they're not finding a favorable forest habitat to live in, then they'll sometimes just stay in the pond.
Oh, I didn't know that. For then most of the year?
Yeah, of them.
Huh. Mm-hmm. And then they don't look rough, right? I remember seeing how graceful they were in the water. I mean, overland, they are just so slow moving, but in the water, they move like seals. I mean, they're just really graceful, and they lose that the rough skin, right?
They get softer looking, smoother.
Yeah.
Getting back to looking carefully, like at that salamander larva right there. So it's got the four legs, the bushy gills, but how do we know that's not a northwestern salamander, which is relatively common around here, though you don't see it very often. They're secretive. And what you look for on that is the narrow snout. So that's what you would call a narrow snout on a salamander.
Okay.
Narrow, of course, is a subjective term, but after you've looked at these over and over, you can see that.
It looks pretty blunt for like a mammal. I hope that we can find a northwest salamander to compare it to.
It's tapered toward the snout end, toward the front end, rather than being U-shaped.
Oh,
it's more angular like that.
Oh, I see.
So it's a really easy thing after you become experienced.
Yep.
So these hatched from eggs laid this past late winter, spring. And there may have been multiple breeding events with the different rains during that period of time. And so you see ones that are different sizes, so they might be slightly different ages, but they're all from this year's breeding. These are all young of 2020, of this year.
Will they emerge from the pond this year then, towards the end of this year?
Yeah, they will. Around here where it's low elevation, relatively warm, they complete the life cycle all within one season. If you go to some of the higher elevations where it's colder, they'll actually overwinter at least once before they change into the land-dwelling newt that you're familiar with.
Uh-huh.
You know, they'll lose the gills and become obviously much bigger. But around here, it might be 4, 5, 6 months that they're in the larval stage. So the end of the season, maybe late summer, early fall, they'll start emerging from this pond here and heading out into wooded areas. And you think, well, around here there's kind of patchy woods, but I'm looking, and I know this area, there's forest not that far away, and these things can move amazing distances. A third of a mile is no big deal.
Wow.
I commonly see them where I live, where there's no pond within a third of a mile, and all these amphibians that need ponds are there. So they move that far pretty easily. So around here, I think they head out to the forest patches to some degree. Some of them may, like I said, might stay in the water. I haven't studied this pond before to know. In the typical situation, you have a forest surrounding a pond or a lake, and they move seasonally back and forth between those habitats. And like I say, though, they're very flexible, and depending on what that surrounding habitat is like, if it's not very good for their purposes of feeding, like here, we're sitting right now in very thick grass, and it would be a very difficult place for a newt, an adult newt, to live because it's hard to move.
Yep.
And there's not really much cover in the way of like a log that holds moisture during the dry spells this summer, for example. So they're going to want to head to where there's a wooded area. You know, they learn where these places are, and they actually can navigate to water and presumably to forests too by odors. That's one cue they can use.
Huh, cool.
They use other cues too. Once they've located, let's say, a good place to spend the time out of the pond, like a forest patch, they can make that navigation back and forth, like I say, a quarter, third of a mile, or even more, sometimes a half a mile. Once they've done it, they know it, and they can find it. As long as there aren't any too difficult obstructions in the way, like dense housing developments.
Uh-huh. Or new obstructions that come into there. So when they're in the pond, are they living off of the egg mass, or are they actively feeding in the pond?
Yeah, once they hatch, they can live off the yolk that was in the egg for a little bit, but pretty much right away they have to start feeding. If you look at this water here, it's teeming with tiny little invertebrates. There are tiny little mayfly nymphs. There are
those little golden bits, those long golden.
See these here with the three little appendages sticking out the rear end?
Yep.
Those are mayfly nymphs that are small enough for these salamanders to eat. And then these are little fly larvae.
The little golden.
The ones that are like straight.
Yep,
and
little submarines.
Yeah, they look like little submarines. And many other kinds of tiny crustaceans you can see swimming around in there. So they feed actively on all those things. That is the salamanders, the newts do. The frog larva is mostly eating detritus, bacteria, microbes, algae, diatoms, tiny little things that aren't really animal life. The salamanders are totally dependent on animal life for their food. at all stages of their lives. Whereas the frogs don't become consumers of animals until they turn into the frog stage. The larvae
are completely vegetarian.
Pretty much, uh-huh. Yeah. Microbes and algae, and that's a little, they might ingest a little bit of animal life, but mostly just incidental to their normal feeding. We've got some big dragonfly nymphs in here, and these are predators, and they're actually a danger to a small frog larva or a small salamander larva. Yep. They have tremendous sharp grappling hook type jaws that they shoot out forward from the head and grab things. Yeah, so they're one of the predators on amphibian larvae.
So what species, can you tell what species of dragonfly that might be?
One could. I can't without keying them out.
Uh-huh, yep.
It's possible to do so, but I wouldn't be able to do it in the field right here.
And is that as big as they get, the dragonfly?
That's about as big, yeah. They're going to start...
By big, but for the radio audience, that's probably a little over an inch long.
Yeah. Yeah, so those may be meadowhawk larvae, perhaps, just small dragonfly. So they'll start crawling out of the water themselves here pretty soon and turning into the flying dragonfly state.
And what about these other bugs here?
Do you know the ones that look like rowboats with the oars out?
Yeah.
Those are called back swimmers, and they are predatory scavenger bugs. So they have piercing and sucking mouth parts. They have the habit of swimming with their belly side up, hence the name back swimmer. And you can see that one swimming and it looks like it is it's a rowing shell with long oars, and that's how they propel themselves. One of the pairs of legs is much longer than the others. They're insects, so they have three pairs of legs, but in this case, one of them is much larger than the other, one pair.
Oh, and then when it got to the dry part in the basin, it turned itself right side up. Huh, how cool.
Yeah.
There's a cool little worm here, too, this little red.
Oh, yeah, bloodworm. It's a type of larval stage of a fly.
Oh.
Midge.
For our next session, maybe we'd bring the microscope out to the field, because there's probably a lot more that we can't see in this scoop. But there's a lot in just... scooping a couple of times the bottom of that pond.
Yeah, the richness of the animal life in this pond, you can just see it's beautiful, really.
So here's our mystery sound again. And it is a red-legged frog. And Jeff, would you like to tell us a bit about
the call of the northern red-legged frog, which is a common species throughout Washington and in this region especially. Pond that we examined today has a good population of them. One thing about their call is that it might not be something you expect, is that most of the time when the males call, and the call such as you heard, they are submerged underwater. So they're calling underwater, and you might be standing there in the water hearing a frog calling, and your head is right very close to it, but you can't see it. It's because it's underwater, submerged. That's kind of an unusual thing. They're not the only species that does that, but...
Well, probably underwater, it sounds really impressive. I mean, because it reverberates and sounds way louder underwater than it would on the surface.
Yeah, so that's a sound you hear during the breeding season in winter. Around here, kind of late winter, early spring, you might hear it, but mostly kind of late winterish. Like I say, only the males will be doing that, and they make those calls to attract females or to interact among themselves. It's kind of like bird song in a way, where two males will sing in nearby territories. And for the frogs, they kind of have this social interaction that is partly involves calling and vocalizing, as well as sometimes wrestling with each other for access to the females. And the females are attracted to the call, and if they like what they hear, they'll approach that male and he will clasp her, amplex her is what it's called. Amplexus is the mating embrace. Then she'll eventually start laying her eggs and he'll fertilize them as they come out.
And the eggs, we would get eggs in a pond of this type. Is that right?
Yes, yes. And it'll be a big mass of several hundred eggs, maybe over 1,000.
Wow.
In one big clump. And they'd be in shallow water attached to submerged plant parts. Then they would hatch out in a week or two, depending on the temperature. Then the little larvae or tadpoles will live for at least a few months more in the pond, growing and eating and growing and growing and eating. And finally, by summertime, they're ready to leave the water and they lose their tail and grow their legs fully, and out of the ponds they come. And you can see them wandering through the forests very far from the breeding ponds. Where I live, I commonly see red-legged frogs there, and it's about 3/10 of a mile from the nearest breeding pond. So that's quite a trek for a little amphibian.
Well, we'll keep our eyes peeled then in late summer for them to be emerging. Is that right?
Yeah, even pretty soon now.
Wow.
Yeah, even in July.
Well, thank you so much for coming to share this field trip with us, and we'll hope it's the start of many field trips that we will do with you and other great naturalists in our area. So thank you so much.
And thank you, Nora, for letting me wade in your pond. There's nothing more fun.
Glad to have you.
Yes. Well, that's it. And thank you so much to everyone. And thanks for listening. This show will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday and 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast sometime next week. Thanks very much once again. And closing music will be Froggy Goes A-Courtin' by Viral Ives. Thank
Perfect.
You.
Happy trails.
Frog with a cordon and he did ridin'. Frog with a cordon and he did ride a sword and a pistol by his side. He went down to Missy Mousy's door. Went down to Missy Mousy's door where he had been many times before. Missy Mouse, are you within? Missy Mouse, are you within? Yes, kind sir, I sit and spin. Missy Mouse up on his knee. Took Missy Mouse up on his knee. Said, Missy Mouse, will you marry me? Without my Uncle Rat's consent. Without my Uncle Rat's consent, I wouldn't marry the president. Uncle Rat laughed and shook his fat sides. Uncle Rat laughed and shook his fat sides, think his niece would be a bride. Mm-hmm.